Huh? Chuck hooked his thumbs over the steering wheel, resting his hands on his lap. He was the most easygoing driver Alfred knew, yet also the most alert. "You do your job well, Al," he said. "You're a fantastic engineer, so there's got to be a reason why the Erie Belt." "There is indeed," Alfred said. "Mid-Pack's buying it." The Fairlane's engine sneezed once in a canine way. Chuck had grown up on a farm near Cedar Rapids, and the optimism of his nature was rooted in the deep, well-watered topsoil of eastern Iowa. Farmers in eastern Iowa never learned not to trust the world, whereas any soil that might have nurtured hope in Alfred had blown away in one or another West Kansan drought. "So," Chuck said, "I imagine there's been a public announcement?"
"No, no announcement."
Chuck nodded, looking past Alfred at the Lambert house.
"Enid'll be happy to see you. I think she's had a hard week. The boys have been sick."
"You'll keep that information quiet."
"Al, Al, Al.
I wouldn't mention it to anyone but you."
"Appreciate it. You're a good friend and a good Christian. And I've got about 4 holes worth of daylight if I'm going to get that hedge pruned back."
The Fairlane inched into motion, Chuck steering it into his driveway with one index finger, as if dialing his broker. Alfred picked up his suitcase and briefcase. It had been both spontaneous and the opposite of spontaneous, his disclosure. A spasm of goodwill and gratitude to Chuck, a calculated emission of the fury that had been building inside him for 11 days. A man travels 2,000 miles... but he can't take the last 20 steps without doing something. And it did seem unlikely that Chuck would actually use the information. Entering the house through the kitchen door, Alfred saw chunks of raw rutabaga in a pot of water, a rubber-banded bunch of beet greens, and some mystery meat in brown butcher paper. Also, a casual onion that looked destined to be fried and served with liver? On the floor by the basement stairs was a nest of magazines and jelly glasses.
"Al?"
Enid called from the basement. He set down his suitcase and briefcase, gathered the magazines and jelly glasses in his arms, and carried them down the steps. Enid parked her iron on the ironing board, and emerged from the laundry room with butterflies in her stomach, whether from lust or from fear of Al's rage, or from fear that she might become enraged herself, she didn't know. He set her straight in a hurry. "What did I ask you to do before I left?"
"You're home early," she said. "The boys are still at the Y."
"What is the one thing I asked you to do while I was gone?"
"I'm catching up on laundry. The boys have been sick."
"Do you remember," he said, "that I asked you to take care of the mess at the top of the stairs? That was the one thing I asked you to do while I was gone."
Without waiting for an answer, he went into his metallurgy lab and dumped the magazines and jelly glasses into a heavy-duty trash can. From the hammer shelf, he took a badly balanced hammer, a crudely forged Neanderthal club that he hated and kept only for purposes of demolition, and methodically broke each jelly glass. A splinter hit his cheek, and he swung more furiously, smashing the shards into smaller shards. But nothing could eradicate his transgression with Chuck Meisner. Or the grass-damp triangles of cheerleading leotard, no matter how he hammered. Enid listened from her station at the ironing board. She didn't care much for the reality of this moment. That her husband had left town 11 days ago without kissing her goodbye was a thing she'd halfway succeeded in forgetting. With the living Al absent, she'd alchemically transmuted her base resentments into the gold of longing and remorse. Her swelling womb, the pleasures of the 4th month, the time alone with her handsome boys, the envy of her neighbors, all were colorful filters over which she'd waved the wand of her imagination. Even as Al had come down the stairs, she'd still imagined apologies, homecoming kisses, a bouquet of flowers, maybe. Now she heard the ricochet of broken glass and glancing hammer blows on heavy-gauge galvanized iron, the frustrated shrieks of hard materials in conflict. The filters may have been colorful, but unfortunately, she saw now, they were chemically inert. Nothing had really changed. It was true that Al had asked her to move the jars and magazines, and there was probably a word for the way she'd stepped around those jars and magazines for the last 11 days, often nearly stumbling on them. Maybe a psychiatric word with many syllables, or maybe a simple word like spite. But it seemed to her that he'd asked her to do more than one thing while he was gone. He'd also asked her to make the boys 3 meals a day, and clothe them, and read to them, and nurse them in sickness, and scrub the kitchen floor, and wash the sheets, and iron his shirts, and do it all without a husband's kisses or kind words. If she tried to get credit for these labors of hers, however, Al simply asked her whose labors had paid for the house and food and linens. Never mind that his work so satisfied him that he didn't need her love, while her chores so bored her that she needed his love doubly. In any rational accounting, his work cancelled her work. Perhaps in strict fairness, since he'd asked her to do one thing extra, she might have asked him to do one thing extra too. She might have asked him to telephone her once from the road, for example. But he could argue that someone's going to trip on those magazines and hurt themselves, whereas no one was going to trip over his not calling her from the road. No one was going to hurt themselves over that. And charging long-distance calls to the company was an abuse of his expense account. You have my office number if there's an emergency. And so a phone call cost the household quite a bit of money, whereas carrying junk into the basement cost it no money. And so she was always wrong. And it was demoralizing to dwell perpetually in the cellar of your wrongness, to wait perpetually for someone to take pity on you in your wrongness, and so it was no wonder, really, that she'd shopped for the dinner of revenge. Halfway up the basement stairs, on her way to preparing this dinner, she paused and gave a sigh. Alfred heard the sigh, and suspected it had to do with laundry and 4 months pregnant. However, his own mother had driven a team of plow horses around a 20-acre field when she was 8 months pregnant, so he was not exactly sympathetic. He gave his bleeding cheek a styptic dusting of ammonium aluminum sulfate. From the front door of the house came a thumping of little feet and a mittened knocking, Bea Meisner dropping off her human cargo. Enid hurried on up the stairs to accept delivery. Gary and Chipper, her fifth grader and her first grader, had the chlorination of the Y about them. With their damp hair they looked riparian, muskratty, beaverish. She called thanks to Bee's taillights. As fast as they could without running, forbidden indoors, the boys proceeded to the basement, dropped their logs of sodden terry cloth in the laundry room, and found their father in his laboratory. It was in their nature to throw their arms around him, but this nature had been corrected out of them. They stood and waited, like company subordinates, for the boss to speak. "So," he said, "you've been swimming." "I'm a dolphin," Gary cried. He was an unaccountably cheerful boy. "I got my dolphin clip." "A dolphin? Well, well." To Chipper, whom life had offered mainly tragic perspectives since he was about 2 years old, the boss more gently said, "You, lad?"
"We used kickboards," Chipper said. "He's a tadpole," Gary said.
"So, a dolphin and a tadpole. And what special skills do you bring to the workplace now that you're a dolphin?"
"Scissors kick."
"I wish I'd had a nice big swimming pool like that when I was growing up," the boss said, although for all he knew the pool at the Y was neither nice nor big. "Except for some muddy water in a cow pond, I don't recall seeing water deeper than 3 feet until I saw the Platte River. I must have been nearly 10. His youthful subordinates weren't following,
They shifted on their feet, Gary still smiling tentatively, as though hopeful of an upturn in the conversation, Chipper frankly gaping at the laboratory, which was forbidden territory except when the boss was in it. The air here tasted like steel wool. Alfred regarded his two subordinates gravely. Fraternizing had always been a struggle for him.
"Have you been helping your mother in the kitchen?" he said.
When a subject didn't interest Chipper, as this one didn't, he thought about girls. And when he thought about girls, he felt a surge of hope. On the wings of this hope, he floated from the laboratory and up the stairs.
"Ask me 9 times 23, Gary told the boss.
"All right," Alfred said. "What is 9 times 23?
207. Ask me another.
"What's 23 squared?
In the kitchen, Enid dredged the Promethean meat in flour and laid it in a Westinghouse electric pan large enough to fry 9 eggs in tic-tac-toe formation. A cast aluminum lid clattered as the rutabaga water came abruptly to a boil. Earlier in the day, a half package of bacon in the refrigerator had suggested liver to her. The drab liver had suggested a complement of bright yellow, and so the dinner had taken shape. Unfortunately, when she went to cook the bacon, she discovered there were only 3 strips, not the 6 or 8 she'd imagined. She was now struggling to believe that 3 strips would suffice for the entire family.
"What's that?" said Chipper with alarm. "Liver and bacon."
Chipper backed out of the kitchen, shaking his head in violent denial. Some days were ghastly from the outset. The breakfast oatmeal was studded with chunks of date like chopped-up cockroach, bluish swirls of inhomogeneity in his milk, a doctor's appointment after breakfast. Other days, like this one, did not reveal their full ghastliness till they were nearly over. He reeled through the house, repeating, "Ugh, horrible, ugh, horrible, ugh, horrible, ugh, horrible."
"Dinner in 5 minutes. Wash your hands," Enid called.
Cauterized liver had the odor of fingers that had handled dirty coins. Chipper came to rest in the living room and pressed his face against the window, hoping for a glimpse of Cindy Meisner in her dining room. He had sat next to Cindy returning from the Y and smelled the chlorine on her. A sodden band-aid had clung by a few lingering bits of stickum to her knee. "Thuckety, thuckety, thuckety," went Enid's masher around the pot of sweet, bitter, watery rutabaga. Alfred washed his hands in the bathroom, gave the soap to Gary, and employed a small towel.
"Picture a square," he said to Gary.
Enid knew that Alfred hated liver, but the meat was full of health-bringing iron, and whatever Alfred's shortcomings as a husband, no one could say he didn't play by the rules.
The kitchen was her domain, and he never meddled.
"Chipper, have you washed your hands?"
It seemed to Chipper that if he could only see Cindy again for one moment, he might be rescued from the dinner. He imagined being with her in her house and following her to her room. He imagined her room as a haven from danger and responsibility.
"Chipper?"
"You square A, you square B, and you add twice the product of A and B," Alfred told Gary as they sat down at the table.
"Chipper, you better wash your hands," Gary warned. "I'm sorry, I'm a little short on bacon," Enid said. "I thought I had more."
In the bathroom, Chipper was reluctant to wet his hands because he was afraid he would never get them dry again. He let the water run audibly while he rubbed his hands with a towel. His failure to glimpse Cindy through the window had wrecked his composure.
"We had high fevers," Gary reported. "Chipper had an earache, too."
Brown, grease-soaked flakes of flour were impastoed on the ferrous lobes of liver like corrosion. The bacon also, what little there was of it, had the color of rust. Chipper trembled in the bathroom doorway. You encountered a misery near the end of the day, and it took a while to gauge its full extent. Some miseries had sharp curvature and could be negotiated readily. Others had almost no curvature, and you knew you'd be spending hours turning the corner. Great, whopping, big planet-sized miseries. The dinner of revenge
was one of these.
"How was your trip?"
Enid asked Alfred, because she had to sometime.
"Tiring."
"Chipper, sweetie, we're all sitting down."
"I'm counting to five," Alfred said.
"There's bacon. You like bacon,"
Enid sang. This was a cynical, expedient fraud, one of her 100 daily conscious failures as a mother.
"Two, three, four,"
Alfred said. Chipper ran to take his place at the table. No point in getting spanked.
"Bless the Lord, this food we use in use to thy service make us e'er mindful, knees of others, Jesus' name, amen," Gary said.
A dollop of mashed rutabaga at rest on a plate expressed a clear yellowish liquid similar to plasma on the matter in a blister. Boiled beet greens leaked something cupric, greenish. Capillary action in a thirsty crust of flour drew both liquids under the liver. When the liver was lifted, a faint suction could be heard. The sodden lower crust was unspeakable. Chipper considered the life of a girl. To go through life softly. To be a Meisner. To play in that house and be loved like a girl.
"You want to see my jail I made with popsicle sticks?" Gary said.
"A jail? Well, well," Alfred said.
The provident young person neither ate his bacon immediately nor let it be soaked by the vegetable juices. The provident young person evacuated his bacon to the higher ground at the plate's edge and stored it there as an incentive. The provident young person ate his bite of fried onions, which weren't good but also weren't bad if he needed a preliminary treat.
"We had a den meeting yesterday," Enid said. "Gary, honey, we can look at your jail after dinner." "He made an electric chair," Chipper said, "to go in his jail. I helped."
"Ah, well, well."
"Mom got these huge boxes of popsicle sticks," Gary said. "It's the pack," Enid said. "The pack gets a discount."
Alfred didn't think much of the pack. A bunch of fathers, taking it easy, ran the pack. Pack-sponsored activities were lightweight, contests involving airplanes of balsa, or cars of pinewood, or trains of paper whose boxcars were books read. Schopenhauer, if you want a safe compass to guide you through life, you cannot do better than accustom yourself to regard this world as a penitentiary, a sort of penal colony.
"Gary, say again what you are," said Chipper, for whom Gary was the glass of fashion. "Are you a wolf?" "One more achievement, and I'm a bear." "What are you now, though, a wolf?" "I'm a wolf, but basically I'm a bear. All I have to do now is conversation." "Conservation," Enid corrected. "All I have to do now is conservation." "It's not conversation?" "Steve Driblet made a guillotine, but it didn't work," Chipper said. "Driblet's a wolf. Brent Person made a plane, but it busted in half. Person is a bear." "Say broke, sweetie, not busted." "Gary, what's the biggest firecracker?" Chipper said. "M-80, then cherry bombs." "Wouldn't it be neat to get an M-80 and put it in your jail and blow it up?"
"Lad," Alfred said, "I don't see you eating your dinner."
Chipper was growing MC-ishly expansive. For the moment, the dinner had no reality.
"Or seven M-80s, he said. "And you blew them all at once, or one after another. Wouldn't it be neat?" "I'd put a charge in every corner and then put extra fuse," Gary said. "I'd wind the fuses together and detonate them all at once. That's the best way to do it, isn't it, Dad? Separate the charges and put an extra fuse, isn't it, Dad?" 7,100 million M-80s, Chipper cried.
He made explosive noises to suggest the megatonnage he had in mind.
"Chipper," Enid said with smooth deflection, "tell Dad where we're all going next week." "The den's going to the Museum of Transport, and I get to come, too," Chipper recited.
"Oh, Enid," Alfred made a sour face. "What are you taking them there for?"
"B says it's very interesting and fun for kids."
Alfred shook his head, disgusted.
"What does B. Meisner know about transportation?"
"It's perfect for a den meeting," Enid said. "There's a real steam engine the boys can sit in."
"What they have,"
Alfred said, is a 30-year-old mohawk from the New York Central. It's not an antique, it's not rare, it's a piece of junk. If the boys want to see what a real railroad is...
Put a battery and two electrodes on the electric chair, Gary said. Put an M80.
Chipper, no. You run a current, and the current kills the prisoner.
What's a current?
A current flowed when you stuck electrodes of zinc and copper in a lemon and connected them. What a sour world Alfred lived in. When he caught himself in mirrors, it shocked him how young he still looked. The set of mouth of hemorrhoidal schoolteachers, the bitter permanent lip-pursing of arthritic men, he could taste these expressions in his own mouth sometimes, though he was physically in his prime. The souring of life. He did therefore enjoy a rich dessert, pecan pie, apple brown Betty, a little sweetness in the world.
They have two locomotives and a real caboose, Enid said.
Alfred believed that the real and the true were a minority that the world was bent on exterminating. It galled him that romantics like Enid could not distinguish the false from the authentic. A poor quality, flimsily stocked, profit-making museum from a real, honest railroad.
You have to at least be a fish. The boys are all excited. I could be a fish.
The mohawk that was the new museum's pride was evidently a romantic symbol. People nowadays seemed to resent the railroads for abandoning romantic steam power in favor of diesel. People didn't understand the first goddamned thing about running a railroad. A diesel locomotive was versatile, efficient, and low maintenance. People thought the railroad owed them romantic favors, and then they bellyached if a train was slow. That was the way most people were. Stupid. Schopenhauer, amongst the evils of a penal colony, is the company of those imprisoned in it. At the same time, Alfred himself hated to see the old steam engine pass into oblivion. It was a beautiful iron horse, and by putting the Mohawk on display, the museum allowed the easy-going leisure-seekers of suburban St. Jude to dance on its grave. City people had no right to patronize the iron horse. They didn't know it intimately as Alfred did. They hadn't fallen in love with it out in the northwest corner of Kansas, where it was the only link to the greater world, as Alfred had. He despised the museum and its goers for everything they didn't know.
"They have a model railroad that takes up a whole room," Enid said relentlessly.
"And the goddamned model railroaders, yes, the goddamned hobbyists." Enid knew perfectly well how he felt about these dilettantes and their pointless and implausible model layouts.
"A whole room?" Gary said with skepticism. "How big?" "Wouldn't it be neat to put some M-80s on a model railroad bridge?"
"Kerpersht! Pacow! Pacow!" "Chipper, eat your dinner now," Alfred said.
"Big, big, big," Enid said. "The model is much, 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 much bigger than the one your father bought you."
"Now," Alfred said. "Are you listening to me? Now." Two sides of the square table were happy, and two were not. Gary told a pointless, genial story about this kid in his class who had three rabbits, while Chipper and Alfred, twin studies in bleakness, lowered their eyes to their plates. Enid visited the kitchen for more rutabaga.
"I know who not to ask if they want seconds," she said when she returned.
Alfred shot her a warning look. They had agreed, for the sake of the boy's welfare, never to allude to his own dislike of vegetables and certain meats.
"I'll take some," Gary said.
Chipper had a lump in his throat, a desolation so obstructive that he couldn't have swallowed much in any case. But when he saw his brother happily devouring seconds of revenge, he became angry and for a moment understood how his entire dinner might be scarfable in no time. His duties discharged and his freedom regained, and he actually picked up his fork and made a pass at the craggy wad of rutabaga, tangling a morsel of it in his tines and bringing it near his mouth. But the rutabaga smelled carious and was already cold. It had the texture and temperature of wet dog crap on a cool morning, and his guts convulsed in a spine-bending gag reflex.
"I love rutabaga," said Gary inconceivably. I could live on nothing but vegetables, Enid averred.
More milk, Chipper said, breathing hard.
Chipper, just hold your nose if you don't like it, Gary said.
Alfred put bite after bite of vile revenge in his mouth, chewing quickly and swallowing mechanically, telling himself he had endured worse than this.
Chip, he said, take one bite of each thing. You're not leaving this table till you do.
More milk.
You will eat some dinner first. Do you understand?
Milk.
Does it count if he holds his nose? Gary said.
More milk, please.
That is just about enough, Alfred said. Chipper fell silent. His eyes went around and around his plate, but he had not been provident, and there was nothing on the plate but woe. He raised his glass and silently urged a very small drop of warm milk down the slope to his mouth. He stretched his tongue out to welcome it.
Chip put the glass down.
Maybe he could hold his nose, but then he has to eat two bites of things. There's the phone. Gary, you may answer it.
What's for dessert?
Chipper said. I have some nice, fresh pineapple.
Oh, for God's sake, Enid.
What?
She blinked innocently, or faux innocently.
You can at least give him a cookie or an Eskimo pie if he eats his dinner.
It's such sweet pineapple, it melts in your mouth.
Dad, it's Mr. Meisner.
Alfred leaned over Chipper's plate, and in a single action of fork removed all but one bite of the rutabaga. He loved this boy, and he put the cold, poisonous mash into his own mouth and jerked it down his throat with a shudder.
Eat that last bite, he said. Take one bite of the other, and you can have dessert.
He stood up.
I will buy the dessert if necessary.
As he passed Enid on his way to the kitchen, she flinched and leaned away.
Yes,
he said into the phone. Through the receiver came the humidity and household clutter, the warmth and fuzziness of Meisnerdom.
Al, Chuck said, just looking in the paper here, you know, Erie Belt stock. 5 5/8 seems awfully low. You sure about this mid-pack thing?
Mr. Replogle rode the motor car with me out of Cleveland. He indicated that the Board of Managers is simply waiting for a final report on track and structures. I'm going to give them that report on Monday.
Mid-pack's kept this very quiet.
Chuck, I can't recommend any particular course of action, and you're right. There are some unanswered questions here.
Al, Chuck said. You have a mighty conscience, and we all appreciate that. I'll let you get back to your dinner.
Alfred hung up, hating Chuck as he would have hated a girl he'd been undisciplined enough to have relations with. Chuck was a banker and a thriver. You wanted to spend your innocence on someone worthy of it, and who better than a good neighbor? But no one could be worthy of it. There was excrement all over his hands.
Gary, pineapple? Enid said.
Yes, please.
The virtual disappearance of Chipper's root vegetable had made him a tad manic. Things were looking up. He expertly paved one quadrant of his plate with the remaining bite of rutabaga, grading the yellow asphalt with his fork. Why dwell in the nasty reality of liver and beet greens when there was constructible a future in which your father had gobbled these up, too? Bring on the cookies, saith Chipper. Bring on the Eskimo pie. Enid carried three empty plates into the kitchen. Alfred, by the phone, was studying the clock above the sink. The time was that malignant five-ishness to which the flu sufferer awakens after late afternoon fever dreams. A time shortly after 5 which was a mockery of 5. To the face of clocks, the relief of order, two hands pointing squarely at whole numbers, came only once an hour. As every other moment failed to square, so every moment held the potential for fluish misery. And to suffer like this for no reason. To know there was no moral order in the flu, no justice in the juices of pain his brain produced. The world, nothing but a materialization of blind, eternal will. Schopenhauer, no little part of the torment of existence is that time is continually pressing upon us, never letting us catch our breath, but always coming after us.
like a taskmaster with a whip.
"I guess you don't want pineapple," Enid said. "I guess you're buying your own dessert."
"Enid, drop it. I wish once in your life you would let something drop." Cradling the pineapple, she asked why Chuck had called. "We will talk about it later," Alfred said, returning to the dining room.
"Daddy?" Chipper began.
"Lad, I just did you a favor. Now you do me a favor and stop playing with your food and finish your dinner right now. Do you understand me? You will finish it right now, or there will be no dessert and no other privileges tonight or tomorrow night, and you will sit here until you do finish it."
"Daddy, though, can you—"
"Right now, do you understand me, or do you need a spanking?"
Tonsils release an ammoniac mucus when serious tears gather behind them. Chipper's mouth twisted this way and that. He saw the plate in front of him in a new light. It was as if the food were an unbearable companion whose company he had been sure that his connections higher up, the strings pullable on his behalf, would spare him. Now came the realization that he and the food were in it for the long haul. Now he mourned the passing of his bacon, paltry though it had been, with a deep and true grief. Curiously, though, he didn't outright cry. Alfred retired to the basement with stamping and a slam. Gary sat very quietly, multiplying small whole numbers in his head. Enid plunged a knife into the pineapple's jaundiced belly. She decided that Chipper was exactly like his father, at once hungry and impossible to feed. He turned food into shame. To prepare a square meal and then to see it greeted with elaborate disgust, to see the boy actually gag on his breakfast oatmeal, this stuck in a mother's craw. All Chipper wanted was milk and cookies, milk and cookies. Pediatrician said, "Don't give in, he'll get hungry eventually and eat something else." So Enid tried to be patient, but Chipper sat down to lunch and declared, "This smells like vomit." You could slap his wrist for saying it, but then he said it with his face, and you could spank him for making faces, but then he said it with his eyes, and there were limits to correction. No way, in the end, to penetrate behind the blue irises and eradicate a boy's disgust. Lately, she had taken to feeding him grilled cheese sandwiches all day long, holding back for dinner the yellow and leafy green vegetables required for a balanced diet and letting Alfred fight her battles. There was something almost tasty and almost sexy in letting the annoying boy be punished by her husband, in standing blamelessly aside while the boy suffered for having hurt her. What you discovered about yourself in raising children wasn't always agreeable or attractive. She carried two dishes of pineapple into the dining room. Chipper's head was bowed, but the son who loved to eat reached eagerly for his dish. Gary slurped and aerated, wordlessly consuming pineapple. The dog-shit yellow field of rutabaga, the liver warped by frying and so unable to lie flush with the plate, the ball of woody beet leaves collapsed and contorted but still entire like a wetly compressed bird in an eggshell, or an ancient corpse folded over in a bog. The spatial relations among these foods no longer seemed to Chipper haphazard, but were approaching permanence, finality. The foods receded, or a new melancholy shadowed them. Chipper became less immediately disgusted. He ceased even to think about eating. Deeper sources of refusal were kicking in. Soon, the table was cleared of everything but his placemat and his plate. The light grew harsher. He heard Gary and his mother conversing on trivial topics as she washed and Gary dried. Then Gary's footsteps on the basement stairs. Metronomic thock of ping-pong ball. More desolate peals of large pots being handled and submerged. His mother reappeared.
"Chipper, just eat that up. Be a big boy now."
He had arrived in a place where she couldn't touch him. He felt nearly cheerful, all head, no emotion. Even his butt was numb from pressing on the chair.
Dad means for you to sit there till you eat that. Finish it up now, then your whole evening's free.
If his evening had been truly free, he might have spent it entirely at a window watching Cindy Meisner.
Noun adjective, his mother said. Contraction possessive noun. Conjunction, conjunction, stressed pronoun, counterfactual verb, pronoun. I'd just gobble that up. And temporal adverb, pronoun, conditional auxiliary infinitive.
Peculiar how unconstrained he felt to understand the words that were spoken to him. Peculiar his sense of freedom from even that minimal burden of decoding spoken English.
She tormented him no further but went to the basement, where Alfred had shut himself inside his lab, and Gary was amassing 37, 38 consecutive bounces on his paddle.
"Tok, tok,"
she said, wagging her head in invitation. She was hampered by pregnancy, or at least the idea of it, and Gary could have trounced her, but her pleasure at being played with was so extremely evident that he simply disengaged himself, mentally multiplying their scores or setting himself small challenges, like returning the ball to alternating quadrants. Every night after dinner, he honed this skill of enduring a dull thing that brought apparent pleasure. It seemed to him a life-saving skill. He believed that terrible harm would come to him when he could no longer preserve his mother's illusions. And she looked so vulnerable tonight. The exertions of dinner and dishes had relaxed her hair's rollered curls. Little blotches of sweat were blooming through the cotton bodice of her dress. Her hands had been in latex gloves and were as red as tongues. He sliced a winner down the line and passed her, the ball running all the way to the shut door of the metallurgy lab. It bounced up and knocked on this door before subsiding. Enid pursued it carefully. What silence, what darkness there was behind that door. Al seemed not to have a light on. There existed foods that even Gary hated. Brussels sprouts, boiled okra. And Chipper had watched his pragmatic sibling palm them and fling them into dense shrubbery from the back doorway if it was summer, or secrete them on his person and dump them in the toilet if it was winter. Now that Chipper was alone on the first floor, he could easily have disappeared his liver and his beet greens. The difficulty? His father would think that he had eaten them, and eating them was exactly what he was refusing now to do. Food on the plate was necessary to prove refusal. He minutely peeled and scraped the flour crust off the top of the liver and ate it. This took 10 minutes. The denuded surface of the liver was a thing you didn't want to see. He unfolded the beet greens somewhat and rearranged them. He examined the weave of the placemat. He listened to the bouncing ball, his mother's exaggerated groans and her nerve-grating cries of encouragement.
"Ooh, good one, Gary!"
Worse than spanking or even liver was the sound of someone else's ping-pong. Only silence was acceptable in its potential to be endless. The score in ping-pong bounced along toward 21, and then the game was over, and then 2 games were over, and then 3 were over. And to the people inside the game, this was all right because fun had been had, but to the boy at the table upstairs, it was not all right. He'd involved himself in the sounds of the game, investing them with hope to the extent of wishing they might never stop. But they did stop, and he was still at the table, only it was 30 minutes later. The evening, devouring itself in futility. Even at the age of 7, Chipper intuited that this feeling of futility would be a fixture of his life. A dull waiting and then a broken promise. A panicked realization of how late it was. This futility had, let's call it, a flavor. After he scratched his head or rubbed his nose, his fingers harbored something. The smell of self. Or again, the taste of incipient tears. Imagine the olfactory nerves sampling themselves, receptors registering their own configuration.
The taste of self-inflicted suffering, of an evening trashed in spite, brought curious satisfactions. Other people stopped being real enough to carry blame for how you felt. Only you and your refusal remained. And like self-pity, or like the blood that filled your mouth when a tooth was pulled, the salty ferric juices that you swallowed and allowed yourself to savor, refusal had a flavor for which a taste could be acquired. In the lab below the dining room, Alfred sat with his head bowed in the darkness and his eyes closed. Interesting how eager he'd been to be alone, how hatefully clear he'd made this to everyone around him. And now, having finally closeted himself, he sat hoping that someone would come and disturb him. He wanted this someone to see how much he hurt. Though he was cold to her, it seemed unfair that she was cold in turn to him. Unfair that she could happily play ping-pong, shuffle around outside his door, and never knock and ask how he was doing. Three common measures of a material's strength were its resistance to pressure, to tension, and to shearing. Every time his wife's footsteps approached the lab, he braced himself to accept her comforts. Then he heard the game ending, and he thought surely she would take pity on him now. It was the one thing he asked of her, the one thing. Schopenhauer. Woman pays the debt of life, not by what she does, but by what she suffers, by the pains of childbearing and care for the child, and by submission to her husband, to whom she should be a patient and cheering companion. But no rescue was forthcoming. Through the closed door, he heard her retreat to the laundry room. He heard the mild buzz of a transformer, Gary playing with the O-gauge train beneath the ping-pong table. A fourth measure of strength, important to manufacturers of rail stock and machine parts, was hardness. With unspeakable expenditure of will, Alfred turned on a light and opened his lab notebook. Even the most extreme boredom had merciful limits. The dinner table, for example, possessed an underside that Chipper explored by resting his chin on the surface and stretching his arms out below. At his farthest reach were baffles pierced by taut wire leading to pullable rings. Complicated intersections of roughly finished blocks and angles were punctuated here and there by deeply countersunk screws, little cylindrical wells with scratchy turnings of wood fiber around their mouths, irresistible to the probing finger. Even more rewarding were the patches of booger he'd left behind during previous vigils. The dried patches had the texture of rice paper or fly wings. They were agreeably dislodgeable and pulverizable. The longer Chipper felt his little kingdom of the underside, the more reluctant he became to lay eyes on it. Instinctively, he knew that the visible reality would be puny. He'd see crannies he hadn't yet discovered with his fingers, and the mystery of the realms beyond his reach would be dispelled. The screw holes would lose their abstract sensuality, and the boogers would shame him. And one evening, then, with nothing left to relish or discover, he just might die of boredom. Elective ignorance was a great survival skill, perhaps the greatest. Enid's alchemical lab beneath the kitchen contained a Maytag with a ringer that swung over it, twinned rubber rollers like enormous black lips. Bleach, bluing, distilled water, starch. A bulky locomotive of an iron, its power cord clad in a patterned knit fabric. Mounds of white shirts in three sizes. To prepare a shirt for pressing, she sprinkled it with water and left it rolled up in a towel. When it was thoroughly redampened, she ironed the collar first and then the shoulders, working down. During and after the Depression, she'd learned many survival skills. Her mother ran a boarding house in the basin between downtown St. Jude and the university. Enid had a gift for math, and so she not only washed sheets and cleaned toilets and served meals, but also handled numbers for her mother. By the time she'd finished high school and the war had ended, she was keeping all the house's books, billing the boarders, and figuring the taxes. With the quarters and dollars she picked up on the side, wages from babysitting, tips from college boys and other long-term boarders, she paid for classes at night school, inching toward a degree in accounting, which she hoped she would never have to use. Already two men in uniform had proposed to her, each of them a rather good dancer, but neither was clearly an earner, and both still risked getting shot at. Her mother had married a man who didn't earn and died young. Avoiding such a husband was a priority with Enid. She intended to be comfortable in life, as well as happy. To the boarding house a few years after the war came a young steel engineer newly transferred to St. Jude to manage a foundry. He was a full-lipped, thick-haired, well-muscled boy in a man's shape and a man's suits. The suits were themselves luxuriantly pleated wool beauties. Once or twice every night, serving dinner at the big round table, Enid glanced over her shoulder and caught him looking, and made him blush. Al was Kansan. After 2 months, he found courage to take her skating. They drank cocoa, and he told her that human beings were born to suffer. He took her to a steel company Christmas party and told her that the intelligent were doomed to be tormented by the stupid. He was a good dancer and a good earner, however, and she kissed him in the elevator. Soon they were engaged, and they chastely rode a night train to McCook, Nebraska, to visit his aged parents. His father kept a slave whom he was married to. Cleaning Al's room in St. Jude, she found a much-handled volume of Schopenhauer with certain passages underlined. For example, "The pleasure in this world, it has been said, outweighs the pain," or, "at any rate, there is an even balance between the two." If the reader wishes to see shortly whether this statement is true, let him compare the respective feelings of two animals, one of which is engaged in eating the other. What to believe about Al Lambert? There were the old man things he said about himself and the young man way he looked. Enid had chosen to believe the promise of his looks. Life, then, became a matter of waiting for his personality to change. While she waited, she ironed 20 shirts a week, plus her own skirts and blouses. Nosed in around the buttons with the iron's tip, flattened the wrinkles, worked out the kinks. Her life would have been easier if she hadn't loved him so much. But she couldn't help loving him. Just to look at him was to love him. Every day she endeavored to cleanse the boys' diction, smooth out their manners, whiten their morals, brighten their attitudes, and every day she faced another pile of dirty, crumpled laundry. Even Gary was anarchic sometimes. He liked best to send the electric engine barreling into curves and derail it, see the black chunk of metal skid awkwardly and roll and spark in frustration. Second best was to place plastic cows and cars on the rail and engineer little tragedies. What gave him the real techno-boner, however, was a radio-controlled toy automobile much advertised on television lately that went anywhere. To avoid ambiguity, he planned to make it the only item on his Christmas list. From the street, if you paid attention, you could see the light in the windows dimming as Gary's train or Enid's iron or Alfred's experiments drained power off the grid. But how lifeless the house looked otherwise. In the lighted houses of the Meisners, of the Schumperts, and the Persons, and the Roots, people were clearly at home, whole families grouped around tables, young heads bent over homework, dens aflicker with TV, toddlers careening, a grandparent testing a tea bag's virtue with a third soaking. These were spirited, unself-conscious houses. Whether anybody was home meant everything to a house. It was more than a major fact, it was the only fact. The family
was the house's soul. The waking mind was like the light in a house. The soul was like the gopher in his hole. Consciousness was to brain as family was to house. Aristotle, suppose the eye were an animal. Sight would be its soul. To understand the mind, you pictured domestic activity, the hum of related lives on varied tracks, the hearth's fundamental glow. You spoke of presence and clutter and occupation, or conversely, of vacancy and shutting down, of disturbance. Maybe the futile light in a house with three people separately absorbed in the basement and only one upstairs, a little boy staring at a plate of cold food, was like the mind of a depressed person. Gary was the first to tire of the basement. He surfaced and skirted the too bright dining room as if it held the victim of a sickening disfigurement and went up to the second floor to brush his teeth. Enid followed soon with seven warm white shirts. She, too, skirted the dining room. She reasoned that if the problem in the dining room was her responsibility, then she was horrendously derelict in not resolving it, and a loving mother could never be so derelict, and she was a loving mother. So the responsibility must not have been hers. Eventually Alfred would surface and see what a beast he'd been and be very, very sorry. If he had the nerve to blame her for the problem, she could say, "You're the one who said he had to sit there till he ate it." While she ran a bath, she tucked Gary into bed.
"Always be my little lion," she said. "Okay. Is he ferocious? Is he wicious? Is he my wicious widow lion?"
Gary didn't answer these questions. "Mom," he said, "Chipper is still at the table, and it's almost 9.
"That's between Dad and Chipper. Mom, he really doesn't like those foods. He's not just pretending." "I'm so glad you're a good eater," Enid said. "Mom, it's not really fair. Sweetie, this is a phase your brother's going through. It's wonderful you're so concerned, though. It's wonderful to be so loving. Always be so loving."
She hurried to stop the water and immerse herself. In a dark bedroom next door, Chuck Meisner imagined, going inside her, that Bea was Enid. As he chugged to ejaculation, he was trading. He wondered if any exchange had a market in Erie Belt options. Buy 5,000 shares, outright, with 30 puts for a downside hedge. Or better, if someone offered him a rate, 100 naked calls. She was pregnant and trading up in cup size, A to B, and eventually even C, Chuck guessed, by the time the baby came. Like some municipality's bond rating in a tailspin. One by one, the lights of St. Jude were going out. And if you sat at the dinner table long enough, whether in punishment or in refusal or simply in boredom, you never stopped sitting there. Some part of you sat there all your life. As if sustained and too direct contact with time's raw passage could scar the nerves permanently, like staring at the sun. As if too intimate knowledge of any interior were necessarily harmful knowledge. Were knowledge that could never be washed off. How weary, how worn a house lived in to excess. Chipper heard things and saw things, but they were all in his head. After 3 hours, the objects surrounding him were as drained of flavor as old bubblegum. His mental states were strong by comparison and overwhelmed them. It would have taken an effort of will, a reawakening, to summon the term placemat and apply it to the visual field that he had observed so intensely that its reality had dissolved in the observing. Or to apply the word furnace to the rustle in the ducts which in its recurrence had assumed the character of an emotional state or an actor in his imagination, an embodiment of evil time. The faint fluctuations in the light as someone ironed and someone played and someone experimented and the refrigerator cycled on and off had been part of the dream. This changefulness, though barely noticeable, had been a torment. But it had stopped now.
Now only Alfred remained in the basement. He probed a gel of ferroacetates with the electrodes of an ammeter. A late frontier in metallurgy, custom formation of metals at room temperature. The grail was a substance which could be poured or molded, but which after treatment, perhaps with an electrical current, had steel's superior strength and conductivity and resistance to fatigue. A substance easy like plastic and hard like metal. The problem was urgent. A cultural war was being waged and the forces of plastic were winning. Alfred had seen jam and jelly jars with plastic lids. Cars with plastic roofs. Unfortunately, metal in its free state, a nice steel stake or a solid brass candlestick, represented a high level of order, and nature was slatternly and preferred disorder. The crumble of rust, the promiscuity of molecules in solution, the chaos of warm things, states of disorder were vastly more likely to arise spontaneously than were cubes of perfect iron. According to the second law of thermodynamics, much work was required to resist this tyranny of the probable, to force the atoms of a metal to behave themselves. Alfred was sure that electricity was equal to this work. The current that came through the grid amounted to a borrowing of order from a distance. At power plants, an organized piece of coal became a flatulence of useless warm gases. An elevated and self-possessed reservoir of water became entropic runoff, wandering toward a delta. Such sacrifices of order produced the useful segregation of electrical charges that he put to work at home. He was seeking a material that could, in effect, electroplate itself. He was growing crystals in unusual materials in the presence of electrical currents. It wasn't hard science, but the brute probabilism of trial and error, a groping for accidents that he might profit from. One college classmate of his had already made his first million with the results of a chance discovery. That he might someday not have to worry about money. It was a dream identical to the dream of being comforted by a woman, truly comforted, when the misery overcame him. The dream of radical transformation, of one day waking up and finding himself a wholly different, more confident, more serene kind of person, of escaping that prison of the given, of feeling divinely capable. He had clays and gels of silicate. He had silicon putties. He had slushy ferric salts succumbing to their own deliquescence. Ambivalent acetylacetonates and tetracarbonyls with low melting points, a chunk of gallium the size of a damson plum. The head chemist at the Midland Pacific, a Swiss PhD, bored into melancholy by a million measurements of engine oil viscosity and Brunel hardness, kept Alfred in supplies. Their superiors were aware of the arrangement. Alfred would never have risked getting caught in something underhanded, and it was informally understood that if he ever came up with a patentable process, the mid-pack would get a share of any proceeds. Tonight, something unusual was happening in the ferroacetate gel. His conductivity readings varied widely, depending on where exactly he stuck the ammeter's probe. Thinking the probe might be dirty, he switched to a narrow needle with which he again poked the gel. He got a reading of no conductivity at all. Then he stuck the gel in a different place and got a high reading. What was going on? The question absorbed and comforted him and held the taskmaster at bay until, at 10 o'clock, he extinguished the microscope's illuminator and wrote in his notebook, "Stain blue chromate 2%, very, very interesting." The moment he stepped from the lab, exhaustion hammered him. He fumbled to secure the lock, his analytic fingers suddenly thick and stupid. He had boundless energy for work, but as soon as he quit, he could barely stand up. His exhaustion deepened when he went upstairs. The kitchen and dining room were ablaze in light, and there appeared to be a small boy slumped over the dining room table, his face on his placemat. The scene was so wrong, so sick with revenge, that for a moment Alfred honestly thought the boy at the table was a ghost from his own childhood. He groped for switches, as if the light were a poison gas he had to stop the flow of. In less hazardous dimness, he gathered the boy in his arms and carried him upstairs. The boy had the weave of the placemat engraved on one cheek. He murmured nonsense. He was half awake but resisting full consciousness, keeping his head down as Alfred undressed him and found pajamas in the closet. Once the boy was in bed, in receipt of a kiss and fast asleep, an unguessable amount of time trickled through the legs of the bedside chair in which Alfred sat, conscious of little but the misery between his temples. His tiredness hurt so much it kept him awake. Or maybe he did sleep, for suddenly he was standing up and feeling marginally refreshed. He left Chipper's room and went to check on Gary. Just inside Gary's door, reeking of Elmer's glue, was a jail of popsicle sticks. The jail bore no relation to the elaborate house of correction that Alfred had imagined. It was a crude, roofless square, crudely bisected. Its floor plan, in fact, was exactly the binomial square he'd evoked before dinner. And this here in the jail's largest room, this bollocksed knot of semi-soft glue and broken popsicle sticks, was a doll's wheelbarrow? Miniature step stool? Electric chair. In a mind-altering haze of exhaustion, Alfred knelt and examined it. He found himself susceptible to the poignancy of the chairs having been made, to the pathos of Gary's impulse to fashion an object and seek his father's approval, and more disturbingly, to the impossibility of squaring this crude object with the precise mental picture of an electric chair that he had formed at the dinner table. Like an illogical woman in a dream, who was both Enid and not Enid, the chair he'd pictured had been at once completely an electric chair and completely popsicle sticks. It came to him now, more forcefully than ever, that maybe every real thing in the world was as shabbily protean underneath as this electric chair. Maybe his mind was even now doing to the seemingly real hardwood floor on which he knelt exactly what it had done hours earlier to the unseen chair. Maybe a floor became truly a floor only in his mental reconstruction of it. The floor's nature was to some extent inarguable, of course. The wood definitely existed and had measurable properties, but there was a second floor. The floor as mirrored in his head. And he worried that the beleaguered reality that he championed was not the reality of an actual floor in an actual bedroom, but the reality of a floor in his head, which was idealized and no more